This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 12th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 169th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. On today's show, we'll be taking it slow with an interview with landmark documentary maker Fred Wiseman as his new film about London's National Gallery hits cinemas.
One of the ideas that unites these disparate sequences is particularly the idea of the different ways a story is told in a painting and in a movie.
We'll be in Singapore to pore over the best of this year's World Press Photo Awards.
Making the photo was the easiest part of the whole thing. Getting there was the hardest part, and that probably is the difference between a very good photographer and a photographer like me who can also use his 10 megapixel iPhone.
And we'll speak to the people behind an intriguing idea, selling tickets to watch PJ Harvey record her new album.
She's very familiar with museums and galleries and wanted to kind of try and find a way of merging her interest in music and her interest in art.
Plus, we'll investigate the who, what, and why of new gay art tours of the Vatican's art treasures, and we'll enjoy a live Midori House session from the very fine Laura Welsh, who has a very good record out soon. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Staying true to form, we're kicking things off with a track from this week's Midori House session with Laura Welsh. After moving to London from her hometown in the West Midlands with her band, Welsh took the time to work out that what she really wanted was to go it alone, and with a voice like hers, why wouldn't she? She's carefully chosen her recording locations and the people she's worked with, moving between LA, New York and London, to lay down different elements to her upcoming album Soft Control, and it's paid off. The record is a bold debut that pairs love for an anthem with a shovel load of soul, and it should prevent her from slipping through the cracks of a crowded solo female market. From Soft Control, here's Laura Welsh in the studio for us singing Hardest Part.
The hardest part I know is giving up a little bit of my control. Open up my heart, just a little part. Though my mind says no. If you're so close to me, why do you remain a mystery? I've analyzed enough, feel like giving up when my doubts take hold. I can't dwell on it, lately I've been going through hell on it. I keep lying to myself, need nobody else, but I do. I need you. I can't sleep on it. Maybe I've been thinking too deep on it. I'm lying to myself. I don't need nobody else, but I do. I need you. I need you. I need you. Yeah. I need you. It's not hard to tell, you've already peered beyond my veil. I let you look inside, it's too hard to hide, cause you know me well. And maybe I'm confused, maybe I ask too much of you. I tend to overthink almost everything, and I should let it be. I can't dwell on it, lately I've been going through hell on it. I keep lying to myself, I don't need nobody else, but I do. I need you. I can't sleep on it, maybe I've been thinking too deep on it. I'm lying to myself, I don't need nobody else, but I do. I need you. Hey, I need you. I need you, yeah. I need you. And if there's an answer, won't you let me know? I'm in the dark, this doesn't feel like home. I've tried my very best, oh why I must confess. At times I love is much too much hands to hold. I can't dwell on it. Lately I've been going through hell on it. Oh, I'm lying to myself. I don't need nobody else, but I do. I need you. I can't sleep on it. Maybe I'm thinking too deep on it. Oh, I'm lying to myself. I don't need nobody else, but I do. I need you. Oh, I need you. I need you. Need you.
That was Laura Welsh with Hardest Part, and there'll be some more tracks from that record and her session later on in the show. National Gallery is the new film by the 84-year-old American documentary-making maestro Fred Wiseman. The film is what you might call classic Wiseman. Detailed, even-handed, crisply shot, and very subtly editorialised. Shot over 3 months, Wiseman's camera looks at every part of the National Gallery. Director Nicholas Penny being pitched to by the marketing department, management meetings, budget meetings, curatorial talks, restorers lecturing on varnish and cleaning, and finding a window into Rembrandt's soul in the process. It's a slow, sure, measured look at art and how we look at art from a master of looking at people, Fred Wiseman.
Velasquez,
Pizarro's,
Rubens,
Picasso,
Holbein,
Stubbs,
Bellini,
Leonardo,
Titian,
Turner,
Rembrandt, Caravaggio,
Michelangelo's,
Poussin,
Vermeer's,
Leonardo da Vinci.
So we're now in the National Gallery having a look quite quietly, but what we must remember is how this was originally intended to be seen.
The idea is always to cover, to have sequences in as many different aspects of the place as possible without any idea in advance of how I'm going to use them, because I don't know what I'm going to find, and I certainly don't know during the shooting how they're going to fit together or if they're going to fit together. So the idea during the shooting is to accumulate as wide a variety of sequences as I can so that I have choice in the editing. In the case of National Gallery, for example, I had 170 hours of rushes. The film is 3 hours, so I used roughly 1/60th of the material.
And obviously there's a lot of darlings that you have to kill in that process. A lot of sequences, quotes, well, maybe personalities that end up on the floor and never to be
Actually, there's very little that I wanted to use that I don't use. It's interesting how the material falls away. I mean, sometimes a sequence you're very enthusiastic about during the shooting, when you get back to the editing room, it's basically, And sometimes something you thought wasn't very interesting saves the day because it's a better transition or explains something about the person. And also sometimes you know when you have a really good sequence and it may stays a good sequence. But the shooting goes so fast and furious and it's tiring and there isn't much time for me to think during the shooting about what the structure is going to be. And it's only during the editing when I have a chance to study the material and see how a sequence which in real time was an hour boils down to 7 minutes and how it then fits to other 5, 3, 2 minute, 30 second sequences that the film begins to emerge.
And your style is very much letting the dramas play themselves out in front of your camera.
Right. I don't intervene.
No. And also, we should, if our listeners aren't familiar with the way that you make films, there's no voiceover, there's no explanation, words don't even flash up on the screen to describe or explain who these people are in any way. So it's very much, and that is part of this the slow burn way that these stories and little dramas and grand dramas play themselves out in your films and in this one that we're talking about today.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the approach is more, to put it in terms of a catchphrase, it's more novelistic than journalistic.
I like a catchphrase. It is. It does have that thing where the characters pop up and they reappear later in the film and all this. This is the way that these things work. One of the questions that seems to come out of your film about the National Gallery here in London is, what is a National Gallery and what is it for? And I'm not suggesting that these are questions that you thought when you went in there necessarily, but do you think that's fair? And do you think those questions are answered not necessarily by your film, but by the protagonists in it?
Well, I think they're raised by some of the sequences in the film.
Yeah.
particular sequence early on between Nicholas Penny, the director of the gallery, and the woman who runs the communications department. But they're certainly not resolved in the film, except to some extent indirectly, because you see that there are crowds of visitors at the National Gallery, and no one says it in the film, but in fact, they have 5 million visitors a year. And you also see the work of the people that give the tours. In America, they're called docents. I've forgotten what they're called, but they're lecturers. Yeah. And they're extremely qualified people who take visitors on tours of the various galleries or expositions.
What did we not know before? When you plan the exhibitions, you think about the different works and that you want to bring together. You go and look at them, of course, and you're very familiar with every individual work, but you never actually see them together. And that is the magic of any exhibition, that if it works, that there's a magic that all of a sudden happens when works start talking to each other.
One of the things that they deal with up close, the restorers and the curators and experts, of course, and also that you deal with, are faces, bodies and faces. There are so many faces in this film of faces staring out of paintings at people.
And paintings staring out at faces.
Exactly. How much did you think about that? A face staring out of a Vermeer from the 16th century or the 17th century looks so similar. There seems to be no change in the idea of humanity from a painter to a filmmaker. I wondered how obvious the parallel was that you were trying to make.
Well, I mean, I did think about that. I think, you know, that's certainly one of the themes in the film. And, you know, it's related to the idea also, I think one of the ways that the various sequences are held together is around the idea of the different ways you tell a story in different forms. How you tell a story in a painting, in a movie, in a ballet, play or a poem, etc. You know, and I think one of the ideas that unites these disparate sequences is particularly the idea of the different way a story is told in a painting and in a movie.
One of the interesting things as well is that you eavesdrop on a couple, two or three other people making films, making bits of TV in the gallery as you make yours.
Right.
That's an interesting thing. There's a bit of...
Well, it's different styles.
And that's really interesting.
I mean, partially it amuses me, but it's also, I mean, I happen to like the style in which I make the films. I'm not, you know, knocking interview films. It's just a different style. I mean, some of the best documentaries ever made are interview documentaries by Marcel Ophuls, for example. Mm. But sometimes it's interesting to illustrate other forms, and sometimes what's said is funny.
And the humor in this film is, I think, very obvious. The points that maybe you're making seem, I mean, we'll leave it up to the viewer and our listeners. But there are some amusing cuts, I suppose, which is, I guess, what you can do with editing and without a voiceover or being heavy-handed with your own editorializing.
Right. I mean, I try not to be heavy-handed, but I think a lot of my films are funny.
Yeah.
At least I hope so.
And one of the things that comes out of it as well is every section of the museum, from the basement to the top floor, if you like, from the management to the restorers and the people that are ripping up the floors and repainting the place after a particular exhibition stuff, everyone gets a fair crack of the whip. Is that something that you care about, or is that something that everyone was sufficiently interesting in their own right? Or was it an idea of giving a balance to you?
I think both. I mean, I do care about it because one of the things I'm trying to do is give a portrait of the institution. And in order to try and do that, I had to go to the various departments. And as it worked out, there were interesting things happening in the various departments. So I used them. But, you know, one of the points of doing, certainly not the only point, but one of the points of doing this kind of film is to present a portrait of the place.
But for whatever reason, at which we can't be certain, this picture, which is probably not entirely finished, but very far along, was changed. And then we get into some interesting things about what happened when it was changed. Because, he, amazingly enough, just turned it sideways and started again. There's no priming in between the two paintings. There's a brown quartz, sort of sandy ground, very typical of late Rembrandt underneath the first composition, but he just turned it and started right on the other canvas, as best we can tell.
I wonder how much you knew about the National Gallery before you entered, whether you want it to be your learning process.
Well, it was. I mean, I'd been to the National Gallery often as a tourist visitor, but I'd never been behind the scenes except for half a day before the shooting, Nick Penny took me on a tour behind the scenes. That was, you know, sometime before the shooting began. And I found that absolutely fascinating, but I didn't know anything about it. And I'm certainly no expert on painting, but I think I learned a lot.
As we all do from watching it.
As a consequence of spending 3 months there and then spending 13 months putting it together.
And there's an interesting sequence in one of the management meetings where Nicholas Penny, the director, is having to be sold on the idea of using the huge portico, the archway at the front of the National Gallery, as the final sort of destination of a charity marathon. The National Gallery will be used as the backdrop for this, the end of this race. He's not very keen on the idea, and I think it gets dropped. Was there any sense in which he wondered whether you making this film about his gallery was a similar thing to that? You know, the idea that it's good publicity, but it's the right sort of publicity because it's a film by Fred Wiseman.
I think he took a risk in giving me permission because it was quite clear from the beginning that the National Gallery, neither he nor anyone else in the National Gallery had any editorial control of the film. He didn't see the film until it was completely finished. And there was an exchange of letters between us before I started where I indicated that I had editorial control. And I think it was extremely generous of him to take that risk and to give me permission.
And I think it turns out well, and I'm sure he's very happy with it. But
he is very happy.
It's an interesting thing between those two. There are two ways of, I guess it's another thing for him. It's a publicity thing. Well, for you, it's making...
Yeah, but he didn't know how the film was going to come out.
Yeah.
Nor did I, for that matter. And those are the only conditions under which I ever work. I never give any editorial control to the people who've given me permission. I mean, the only time I've done something remotely like it is when I made Missile, which is a movie about launching Minuteman missiles, and I let the Pentagon review the film to make sure there were no launch codes. And I didn't want to know the launch codes.
Seems fair enough.
I'd have a lot of new friends if I knew the launch codes. But there was nothing like no national security issues involved in the National Gallery.
Well, for the time being, Fred Wiseman has the keys to the National Gallery. To the benefit of all of us, Fred Wiseman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's about music, film, philosophy, science. It's about life. Anything you are interested in goes into art.
This painting got vandalized a couple of months ago. Some crazy guy came in with a red aerosol, and I came in the next morning. Cleaned up perfect.
And Fred Wiseman's National Gallery is out now. After break, we'll be speaking to one of the winners at this year's World Press Photo Exhibition in Singapore.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. In Singapore, the Colonial Raffles Hotel welcomes the 57th World Press Photo Exhibition. It's a showcase of the best in photojournalism from 2013, 151 compelling images out of nearly 100,000 submissions from around the world have been selected. Monocle's Deputy Bureau Chief in Singapore, Jason Lee, speaks with one of the winners, Julia Schrank. But first, here he is with Exhibition Manager Lawrence Korteweg.
What you can see now in the Raffles Hotel in Singapore is the World Press Photo 2014 exhibition, and the exhibition is actually about 2013. It's an overview of what happened in 2013 in only high-quality visuals by, well, according to the jury and according to me myself too, the best press photographers in the world. The reason why we are organizing the contest and we are traveling with the exhibition is that we believe in the power of the image. And we believe the profession of photography is extremely important to our society. And with this exhibition and with this contest, we are trying to build a platform for professional photographers. And next to that, we try to show their work to as many people as possible in order to show them what the world is like at this moment and to in order to inspire their understanding of the world by confronting them with everything that happens and that ranges from, there's 9 different categories, so that goes from general news to spot news to daily life to contemporary issues and to portraits, nature and sports. And I would say within a half an hour you can get a good view of, or you get a thought-provoking experience that hopefully might lead to something.
Well, the award is in its 57th year. Technology has progressed a lot since. Now there's this cell phone. Anyone can take a picture. What distinguishes a professional photographer, a photojournalist, from someone with an iPhone?
As two of the award winners already said, Robin Hammond and Julius Schrank, they said the pictures we took were not that difficult to make, but reaching that situation was the most difficult part of our journey to make this photo. And that's probably where you can see good photographers make a difference, because you have to have an eye for the situation. You have to know where to get your information, where to get into a country. And then, of course, you need your quality and your skills, of course. But that's what these two photographers were saying, that making the photo was the easiest part of the whole thing. Getting there was the hardest part. And that probably is the difference between a very good photographer and a photographer like me who can also use his 10 megapixel iPhone camera.
And on the flip side, now all the images are on the internet, but yet a big part of the World Press Photo Exhibition is that it's a traveling exhibition, yeah, physically going from country to country. Why is there a need to do that even today?
Well, I think there's different theories to that, but what I believe in personally is that, yes, there is a lot of information on the internet. There's a lot of digital information. If you want to, you can just keep reading your whole life and never finish, of course. But we consume the news in a different way than we do when we read a newspaper or when we, for example, visit the World Press Photo Exhibition. If you see these photos, the photos in the exhibitions are printed on a huge format. It's like 1.6 meters by 1.1 meter. Perhaps there are some people with screens of that size at home. I don't think there's a lot. And it really makes a difference when you see the photo on your iPhone or on such a big printed panel. You can zoom into things, you can take your distance, and you really process the information in another way. And we think the world still needs and will need this experience for the time to come. And we also see it in our visitor numbers. They're growing every year.
My name is Julia Schunk. The story in the picture is, it's a funeral. It's a funeral of a general of the KAA, the Kachin army. In first place, you probably wouldn't reckon that it's a funeral, as it's more a happy picture.
It kind of looks like a karaoke session.
Yeah, indeed, that's what it is, because they love karaoke, they love singing. It's one of these moments late at night after the funeral when the mood kind of rises, because usually the sad part is the ceremony, taking the dead to the grave, bury him. But after that, most of the times you start, having like some kind of party. There will be food provided. You will have drinks. You come together. You talk about the dead. And in that case, the mood just got better and better. Also, because of the soldiers, of course, they were drinking and they were having fun. And then there was this one guy with his karaoke machine, this piano thing playing. And then they all just sang along.
It's quite an intimate moment. How do you, as an outsider, persuade them to incorporate you into what I guess is quite a personal time of grieving and celebration of the general's life?
The thing is, if you are, as a Westerner, like me, relatively tall, blonde hair, you're like an alien, You don't really belong there, and everybody sees that right away. So the only thing to get close to the people, the only possible way is to bring time and to show interest in them, in their personal stories. And I was there for already a few hours. I talked to many of these guys, even though, it's hard to communicate, but still, it works. And, after some time, they just more or less forgot about me, and they accepted me as part of their group. So they were just acting naturally. And this you can only achieve if you have really, honest interest and if you have patience.
So what does it mean to you to win the World Press Photo?
Well, as World Press Photo is probably, the ultimate goal for every photojournalist. Of course, I'm extremely happy and proud to, you know, to be award winner. Your work as a photographer, as a storyteller, gets spreaded out, which is of course what, you know, what we want. Huh? We want a big audience to talk about these issues that we document. So WordPress Photo is like, you know, the perfect opportunity to do it. You know, there are so many exhibitions touring all over the world. I get the opportunity to talk to foreign media all over, you know, like I do with you now. It's extremely good and big tool to spread your work.
That was Julia Schrank, a winner at this year's World Press Photo Asia. The exhibition is on at Raffles Hotel in Singapore until the 1st of February. Coming up in the second half of the show, we find out why PJ Harvey has decided to record her next album in a box in Somerset House with a revolving audience, and we take a look at sense and sexuality via the buff blokes and hot bods in the works of Michelangelo and Leonardo in the new gay-friendly art tour at the Vatican. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. But first, we're going to hear from Laura Welsh again. After performing for us, she sat down in the studio with culture producer Holly Fisher to discuss her creative process and evenings spent round the piano with John Legend. Why not? But first, here she is with another track from that great record, Soft Control. This is Here For You.
I know we'll make it. I know we'll make it through. Ooh. One thing's for certain. I will be here for you. Ooh. Don't overthink it. Don't question what we do. Ooh. One thing's a constant. I will be here for you. Ooh. We all go through changes, love in different places. That doesn't mean that we have to part. And when you feel like nobody's on your side, please believe I'm never too far. 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 I will be here for you. I will be here for you. And I will be here for you. I will be here, I'll be here for you. Whether it's sunshine, whether it be rain, oh, we'll stand the pressure, I will ease the pain. We all go through changes, love in different places. That doesn't mean that we have to part. And when you feel like nobody's on your side, please believe I'm never too far. 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 And I will be here for you. 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 And when you cast away and you feel alone, I'll try to find you. I'll try to guide you home. 'Cause I will be here for you. I will be here for you. And I will be here for you. I will be here for you. I will be here for you.
I've kind of been doing music for a long while now, but I've been working on this album, Soft Control, for the last couple of years. So I've just been, yeah, in the studio writing and recording, and it's just been like come to the point now where I'm about to release the album, which is amazing. So I started doing some songs online and things like that, where I just kind of took a bit of time out to write before I signed my deal. Because I'd been in bands previously, and I kind of moved to London to do my last year of studying music from Birmingham. So I did that, and I was in bands for a while and sort of got like a good sense of like gig experience and things, but that all kind of came to a head and sort of finished, and I decided to sort of take a step back and figure out what my next steps were. And in that time I wrote some of the key songs that are on this album, and I just kind of started putting music online on my Tumblr site and editing short films to those tracks, and yeah, it kind of built from there.
And so you were in bands before. How do you think your sound sort of developed from being in a band to becoming a solo artist?
It's changed a lot, you know, because I think it's important to sometimes, for me anyway, from my own experience, it was kind of good to figure out exactly what I didn't want to do, you know, in order to find out what I knew direction-wise I wanted to go in for the record. So without that kind of experience and without that sort of, when things kind of fell apart for me in that way, it was sort of like a chance for me to really just actually take a step back for a while and just actually have the freedom to write what I wanted to without any like any other outside opinions, any expectations or anything. And that's where I kind of found musically, it was just like I just wanted to make music that, you know, I liked, and that's what I did.
So what got binned? What do you not want to do?
Well, I guess because I was in bands, it was just kind of, I think I wanted to just sort of have the complete creative control. So, you know, I wanted to be able to work and collaborate with, you know, the producers I wanted to on the record, which, and the writers that I was, you know, musically I loved. So it was really important that I found those, the right people to do that with.
I read that you've co-written songs with people like John Legend. How has that come about?
The John Legend track that's on the record was just actually, I was out in LA doing a lot of like recording and writing for the album. And we actually just did a late night session. We didn't start till like 8 o'clock in the evening. And it was just really, really relaxed. Like we just literally went into the studio, sat around a piano. I'd played him a couple of songs, like demos, rough ideas. And we actually just wrote that song in about 4 hours. So it happened really quickly. And we just literally put the piano and a vocal down, and I left the studio. And I remember sort of getting back to my hotel and putting the really like scrappy demo on that we'd done, and I loved it. And he's, you know, he's an incredible musician, so it was great to work with him. It
sounds like a Christmas album, like round the table with Laura Welsh and John Legend. Earlier on we were having a little chat before the session, and you were telling me that you're straight back in the studio now and really excited about the fact that you've kind of finished one album and you can start with a fresh page and start a brand new one. Is the writing and making the music your favourite part of the process, or do you prefer the performance side?
Yeah, I love being in the studio. That's a huge thing. It's just, I think I'm always going to be writing. Even if I'm at home, I'll pick up an acoustic guitar and I'll start ideas. And I think that's just, for me, it's like, it's a good outlet for kind of, you know, being creative and just that whole like mindset of getting, you know, your thought process out there. So there's never sort of a time where I think, right, I'm going to stop and take a break. I like that process of like working with people and collaborating. And on the other flip side, I mean, performing is amazing when you sort of like get in front of an audience and you kind of get that instant feed of whether, or even if they start to sort of like sing your lyrics back, it's still quite weird, that whole process.
That was Laura Welsh speaking to Holly Fisher. The new album, Soft Control, is out in March on Outsiders Recorded, and she'll be touring it this year. And we'll remind you in March that record is out, because a very good one it is too. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. P PJ Harvey, the British singer, songwriter, poet and maker of 8 excellent albums, is set to start recording her 9th. No biggie, you might say, but you'd be wrong, because Polly, to our mates, is going to record it in a glass box in the bowels of London's Somerset House. It's a recording process, but also an art project dreamt up by Harvey, a former art student, and Art Angel, that august organisation that is always confounding expectations in site-specific art, witty interventions, and wonderful installations. To try to glean just what we might see and hear as we get close to that all-important moment of creation, I invited Michael Morris, Art Angel co-director, and Jonathan Reakey, the director of Somerset House, into my very own glass box of inspiration to find out a bit more.
It's a new wing at Somerset House, which is only recently opened up to the public after 200 years nearly of it being an office block, really. And latterly, for many years, it was the headquarters of the Inland Revenue. So,
which for our international listeners, we should say, is the tax.
The tax guys
here in the UK.
Exactly.
Quite a transformation, making it into a recording studio for a recording artist with a slightly political oeuvre. So it's kind of chalk and cheese.
Well, yes, you could say that. I'm sure Polly's secretly amused by the fact that she's in the staff gymnasium of the Inland Revenue. And we're also using the rifle range, which I think originally was to do with a World War One sort of civil service rifles regiment
or
something.
Thing.
Sort of, yeah, dad's army.
Home guard thing, I should say, yeah. So it's an amusing thing. We said before we switched the microphones on that every office should have their own rifle range. We'll go back to who and why Somerset House needs its own rifle range a little bit later on. But Michael, let's talk about the project. When you walked in here, you said, you're sort of taking notes on the right sort of microphones to use, the right sort of glass to have from studio to recording booth. Talk us through what this recording studio is going to look like.
Well, I mean, I think that actually it will look less like a recording studio and more like a kind of space in a museum or an art gallery. I mean, one of the things that Polly, you know, the first sort of brief, really, when we began talking a year ago, was she wanted to record her new album in a public situation.
In a former tax office.
Well, at that point, we didn't know about the tax office, but it was the idea was that she would do it as a kind of piece of sculpture. She spends an awful lot of time in art galleries. Her first sort of impulse was to train as a sculptor before she got a recording contract. She actually did go and do an art foundation course. So she's very familiar with museums and galleries and wanted to kind of try and find a way of merging her interest in music and her interest in art. So the first sort of note was, let's do it in an art gallery. And we're not doing that. We're doing it in an old gymnasium underneath Somerset House, which we've made feel like a kind of gallery or museum space. Down by the water.
And there's an interesting idea. I mean, the space itself is not an obvious space. It's not where the ice rink is. It's not in an obvious. It's not in one of the gallery spaces at Somerset House as well. So there's an interesting idea that you kind of have to go and find this thing, despite the fact it's in a famous cultural institution on the Strand in London. There's an idea that you maybe have to go and find this, Jonathan.
That's right, and that's obviously exciting for the audience because they'll go somewhere that other people haven't been before. But actually, it's in a space that as soon as I got the job, I earmarked as studio space for artists, because one of the things I want Somerset House to be about is about artists making work and not just a place where work is presented. So when Michael brought this project to us, it was absolutely perfect match, because it's exactly the kind of thing I envision Somerset House doing.
Polly was particularly attracted by the idea that Somerset House would be a place where projects were made, whether they were music projects, sculptural projects, projects that build in technology to design, that Somerset House will become a place where associated with the making of things. So to get the ball rolling, we're going to make a record there.
There's an interesting idea at the heart of this, I suppose, is how much of making something becomes a performance. How much is it just graft and technique and practicing one's craft and art, and how much does it become a performance? This is obviously something that the two of you have talked a lot about with Polly, presumably. What have you come up with?
We've tried to avoid using the word performance very much, because that's what she does most of the time. Yeah. And there are times when the process of making a record might be pretty mundane. So depending on when you happen to go, if you happen to go at 3 o'clock on a Friday,
you get someone making the teas.
You might sort of experience a discussion about the tuning of a bass guitar, or you might actually hear a number rehearsed from beginning to end. No two members of the audience will experience the same thing.
And I suppose this is obviously it's an unknown quantity for everyone involved in this project is exactly what you're going to get. You might have an idea. Obviously, you know what the space is going to look like. Polly knows perhaps the bones of the songs she's going to put the flesh on in front of her public. But I suppose it's all the beauty of it as well. It's quite an unknown quantity. From
I think that's
to end.
Why it's exciting and why we're really not sure, even though we're a week away, precisely what it'll feel like to be within the studio and to be outside it. As you may know, it's glazed with a one-way vinyl film, which means that we as the audience can see in, but Polly and her producers and her musicians, engineers, won't always be aware, they won't be aware of the fact that there's a sort of crowd of onlookers.
There's a thing about the sort of idea of being there at the moment of creation as we get kind of nearer and nearer to wanting to delve into artists' lives and peer in through the studio letterbox. This is kind of satisfying people's very natural curiosity. You're frowning.
No, Michael, I think you're absolutely right.
Lovely thing of wanting to be there and kind of going, I was there when
there's a tremendous urge to be not just a spectator, but to be a participant.
Okay.
In many areas of cultural life. This may be to do with the fact that when we're online, we're interactive, that actually it's not a passive experience. And I don't think people want their real life, their sort of real world art experiences to be passive.
Absolutely, and that's exactly the space that I see Somerset House occupying. Yeah. So you don't just come and see finished work, you might see work in progress, or in this case, participate.
There is that thing, I think people want, and it's not a prurient thing or a nosy thing, people really get a kick out of seeing other people do their work. It loses any sort of mundanity. Whether even if it was a tax office, still it would be fascinating to see anybody almost go about their working day. And people, as you say, want to get sort of closer and closer. How do you, Jonathan, assure that Somerset House, not that you can make an assurance, but facilitate the ability that people can make art kind of undisturbed or disturbed in a good way? By making art at Somerset House?
Well, you have to manage that really carefully. You have to be very sensitive to the needs of the artists and makers. I've done that for many years. It's sort of what I do.
Yeah.
And although we haven't announced it formally yet, we will be creating a lot of studio space at Somerset House over the next 18 months. And so it will become known as a centre where people make things.
That was Art Angel co-director Michael Morris and Somerset House director Jonathan Reakey. The sold-out event takes place from Friday the 16th of January, so get your begging letters out. After the break, Gay Vatican Art Tours.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Now, far be it for us to say if Michelangelo, Leonardo or Caravaggio were, to use the 16th century terminology appropriate for such titans of art, confirmed bachelors, but an Italian gay art tour company has hit upon unprecedented success, not by looking at the perhaps understandable works of David Hockney or Francis Bacon, but of the art collection of that none more conservative stronghold, the Vatican. And why not? Because let's face it, there's a lot of male flesh on show in these Renaissance masterpieces. Muscles ripple from Michelangelo's David. Sensuality drips from Raphael. Sex oozes from Caravaggio. So, gay art tours of the Vatican. To discuss, we'll speak to Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor at Corriere della Sera.
It's a great deal, something new. Maybe it's too far also for the Pope, Francesco, but now in Italy you can have a gay-friendly tour in Italy, in Milan, but especially in the Vatican Museum, so in the heart of the Catholic culture, discovering the gay identity of the artist, but not only the gay identity, it's not only about gossip or biographical issues, it's something about the test and the model of Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and other great artists. So it's a new glasses we can use to see these great works like the Sistine Chapel. It's the main curse, of course. The name of this issue, The Other Side of the Sistine Chapel, is made by an agency, an Italian tour operator, Quickie, specialized in gay and lesbian tourism. And it's something new and I think could be amazing.
So we're focusing on the lives of the artists. And I mean, their sort of sexuality is much discussed, isn't it? Leonardo, for example, and Michelangelo, their sexuality was sort of up for discussion. That aside, obviously, they used life models. The famous Creation of Adam, for example, are these sorts of works of art that clearly used naked men and especially naked men and naked women as life models. Is there an element of trying to find out whether these models, these muses perhaps, had relationships with the artists?
Yeah, it's full of point of view we can use. First of all, we have to think about the universal idea in the Renaissance, Italian Renaissance, of the beauty. And we can see some also classic sculpture, like twink is a gay term that is used in this gay-friendly guide, or beer if the man is more rude. But also we have some biographical aspects we can't forget. It's Leonardo and Michelangelo has a lot of scholars, beloved, really beloved scholars. Also Caravaggio, another great, great artist. There's also a film by Derek Jarman about the sexuality, the gay sexuality of Caravaggio. And the Sistine Chapel is full of naked men. And the creation of man, mano a mano, we have the first man completely naked, while God is dressing a flesh-colored tunic. It's a sort of revenge, maybe, of Michelangelo, because the works were covered after the work was finished, were covered by tunics. So it's not something only eccentric, but it's a sort of a revenge of the really sensual ideal of beauty of these artists, like Caravaggio, like Leonardo, and of course Michelangelo.
And can we get the idea that from these tours, that, you know, they make perhaps a vaguely amusing sort of headline, but there is something very important about the idea of beauty in here, isn't there, Luca? Whether it's male or female beauty, we shouldn't be ashamed of it. And I suppose that this tour, presumably it's the first of its kind, presumably art tours of the 16th and 17th century when these artists were working, concentrated on the spiritual rather than the sensual side, presumably, of these pictures.
Yeah, that's an intriguing point, because it's a meeting between sometimes the sensibility of the artist, and we don't have to forget the buyer, because sometimes the buyer were gay too, and sometimes they asked to the artist to put the face of their beloved man in the portrait. So it's a sort of two codes, the universal codes of the beauty that belongs to the artist, and sometimes the code of a different sexuality, different if we think about the Catholic model. So it's something that can maybe open our eyes, and I don't know, maybe also the Vatican eyes.
Do we know what the Vatican think of these tours that are focusing so much on the body rather than the spirit, perhaps?
Yeah, I think sometimes the silence is not only silence, it's a sort of conspiracy, because they can't maybe talk about it, because the first rule of the communication is to don't say against something you don't want to make it well known. On the web, you can see some review of this issue of, about the other side of the Sistine Chapel. Maybe it's not the other, it's not the dark, it's the crampish side, it's the rainbow side. At the moment, we don't have reaction from Vatican, also because we have a sort of, we can say, revolutionary pope in the Vatican. And a topic like this could be, yeah, really hard to manage.
So I suppose that a silence is, it could be the Vatican ignoring that these tours are happening. It could be a small act of condoning these tours, or at least allowing them to happen and maintaining a stately silence, you think, Luca?
Yeah, it's a sort of, Maybe we can say silence, decent silence, and also we can remember the words of the Pope in trip coming back from Brazil. He say, "If a gay follow the Lord, how can I judge this person?" And it was a big point of discussion in the Catholic. I think the silence could be a good ambient for this intriguing, amazing, a little bit eccentric experience.
That was Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor at Corriere della Sera newspaper in Milan. To find out more about those tours online, just search for Quiki. That's with two I's. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Join us next week when we'll be getting a Japanese tattoo in Portland and finding out about the scent of art in Madrid. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, and it's high time I lured her back from the Vatican and all those rippling muscles. Time for one final song from this week's Midori House session. Here's Laura Welsh with Ghosts. Thanks for tuning in.
Bones shake, it's lonely, it's late, and footsteps echo and glimmers of hate. Howling candles are blowing a sound. What can I tell you? It's all going down. And there's a silence deep down in my soul. Hard times just won't let me go. I need you to help me through. I can't lay these ghosts to rest, though I'm scared and it's dark. Oh, I know it's all a mess, the faceless and the headstrong. I've got them staring back at me, but my will is still strong. And I won't let them take me in, me in, me in, me in. Angels crying, lost in shame. Demons laughing, playing the game. And there's a silence deep down in my soul. Hard times just won't let me go. And I need you to help me through. I can't lay these ghosts to rest, though I'm scared and it's dark. Oh, I know it's all a mess, the faceless and the headstrong. I've got them staring back at me, but my will is still strong. I won't let them take me in, me in, me in, me in, me in. Days roll off from dusk till dawn for all time, all time. My faith is grown, the seeds we've sown will be alright, alright. And there's a silence deep down in my soul. And I need you to help me through. I can't lay these ghosts to rest, though I'm scared. And it's dark. Oh, I know it's all a mess, the faceless and the headstrong. I've got them staring back at me, but my is still strong, and I won't let them take me easy.